1500 to 1550, this was the most important development, I point out, in monasticism in this age of the church. Not the most important development in monasticism, but the most important development in this age of the church. Service in the world, rather than withdrawal from the world, becomes the ideal of monasticism. You recall the last phase that we discussed, the lesson we discussed yesterday, the Cistercian movement was extremely isolationist, contemplative. This is just the opposite. Orders of men and women remained single, except only a bare living from the church, as I point out here, subjected themselves to a discipline and gave themselves to various areas of service to mankind on behalf of Christ, including the areas of scholarship. There was group poverty as well as individual poverty. But, however, monasteries often became very wealthy, although its individual members owned nothing but had use of the wealth. For instance, in some orders, monks would hire serfs to do the manual labor and became a little fat and lazy. Monasteries tended to go in a cycle, all times. They tended to become wealthy because if you have a lot of people, a lot of dedicated people, working very hard, who are often producing, and yet spending very little, nothing on luxuries, then you tend to accumulate wealth. Matter of fact, that's one of the big things about capitalism. The fundamental principle, and Reaganomics is struggling with this now. If capitalism will work, only capitalism permits personal profit, excess cash, as well as socialism doesn't. So an individual, it will individually control excess cash as opposed to everything belonging to everybody. And capitalism will work if a person will take that excess cash and invest it in the means of production. Buy stocks and bonds and companies to create jobs and prosperity continues. But if that excess cash is wasted in conspicuous consumption, not used that way, not sort of reinvested, at least some of it's not, then capitalism won't work. Well, this is same principle here. See, they had the excess cash at the end of the day, because they lived very simple lives, went back into the system simply because their vows called for poverty and trusting obedience to a simple life. And so my theory is that because you see the principle, they came to become wealthy. So anybody, if you work much, spend little, tend to get money. They work much, spent little, but then it tend to corrupt them. They had to be a reform movement. Vermont, they had a sort of built-in system for becoming wealthy and then sometimes corrupt. The mendicant idea was that a group or order would divest itself. The mendicant approach to monasticism was an attempt to break this cycle. Was an attempt to put a stop to this by having the order divest itself of lands and wealth and live by free will, daily gifts from the people. This practice is called mendicancy. It became begging orders. This is the way a monk could keep from accumulating this wealth which led to their corruption. How? Simply, never accumulate any. Okay? Divest themselves of their land. You don't have a monastery with all of its land. What you have is an order of men who only beg, in fact. However, even the mendicant orders acquired wealth. Begging is good money, by the way. And gradually stepped back into the degenerative state of the older monastic system. Didn't entirely work. But you know that? Professional begging, like you don't realize that, but the right kind of begging, the right place reproduces a lot of money. Anyway, so they tried to break this cycle, but they were not completely successful. As a part of the mendicant, but you know what mendicant means? If somebody traveled around and lived off of free will donations or begging in a sense. Although it was not begging in that. Wasn't the kind of begging you find in India where they were not poor people. Just if it was an order that people would recognize as monks, and they could do service to God by helping to support them. There were lay brotherhoods, that is, associate members of the orders, and there came to be three levels in these orders. The men are the friars. They had a lot of roast. There's the men, there's the women, the nuns. This is the female orders as we know it come from this period, and the laymen are the brothers, the primary, secondary, and tertiary, friars, nuns, and brothers. Now keep in mind these were sort of lay associates. The nuns were not considered clergy; they were considered a lay order. You realize that? They're a part of the lay system. The lay orders, what made them lay orders, or associate orders, was that they were connected to these mendicant orders, but they did not take vows of celibacy and poverty. They took vows of obedience, but not celibacy and poverty. The mendicant orders were, from the first, immediately subject to the Pope. They became something of a papal militia. They were the strong right arm of the Pope. We're going to see later these orders are what the Pope uses in the Inquisition. The old orders had resisted papal authority and often had such powers to intimidate the papal throne itself. So this is different in the mendicant orders. That is, the subject to the Pope was always a matter of independent of the Pope, especially in England and Scotland, as I've already discussed that. I want to discuss the two most important mendicant orders, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. These became great enemies. First of all, the Franciscans, named after their founder, the famous Francis, or St. Francis of Assisi. He has been called the most beloved saint in the history of the Church. We've already met him as being the only one who was interested in evangelizing the Muslims rather than simply exterminating them from Europe, and he died on a missionary tour among the Muslims in North Africa. Francis, as a young man, was wealthy, frivolous, but he was a sensitive young man. He underwent a conversion and set his face toward a life of direct imitation of Jesus. There's much of this in the mendicant orders, in the monastic system as a whole. The idea that the Christian life, the perfect Christian life, the highest Christian life, was to imitate the lifestyle of Jesus. This is not true. To follow Jesus does not mean to imitate his lifestyle in the sense of traveling about, remaining single, owning little or nothing. That's not what is meant when we follow in the steps of Jesus. What is meant, of course, is the moral values of the system of righteousness. See, Jesus never called on anybody to remain single and travel about and have no home and live like that. We saw this, by the way, in the early monastic movement, you recall, the beginnings of it. Men were drawn to the very attractive life of St. Francis of Assisi, and they wanted to join him. And so he set down a rule for them. And I list the scriptures here, Matthew 16, 24 through 26, Matthew 19, 21, and Luke 9, 1 through 6. But, and I don't need my Bible. Somebody give me a Bible. Let's look at somebody. They said, what are your rules? Well, he went back to the gospel, which is unusual. The Bible was not used very much. As the rule for his order. When Jesus told his disciples, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever would save his life will lose it. Whosoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world, loses his own soul? Matthew 19:21. This, of course, is remember the rich young ruler? You recall that Anthony, back in the early days of monasticism, heard the story of the rich young ruler? Well, if you would be perfect, do what? Go and sell what you possess and give it to the poor. You will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. And that's what he told him. And this kind of life. Well, some of the friends of Francis, against his will, organized the order on behalf of the church. Listen, he didn't organize it. He was against it. He said, if you want to live that kind of life, he said, so we want to follow you. He said, okay, you don't have to follow me. Just, if you like this kind of life, just go live it. The life of poverty, humility, service to the poor, he was. He was a genuine servant to the poor. Many stories about him, and most of which I'm sure are true, tell amazing stories of self-sacrifice. He was the real thing. So many were the following. They liked that. He said, especially, it's very attractive in a very superstitious, ugly, immoral age. And so he said, well, just go do it. But no, they wanted to organize. He didn't want to. So some of his friends organized an order on behalf of the church, named it after him, and he wasn't even for it. They required an oath. Whereas Francis wanted the men to be able to change their minds to go back to the ordinary life. He was against that. He said, you follow me? If you don't want to do it anymore, you don't have to. After his death, the order, somewhat far now from the idea of him, him whose name it bore, they divided up. The order did not really reproduce his kind of life. However, there remained the Franciscan order, the Franciscan order and the Capuchin order as the heritage of St. Francis. So when you look at the Franciscan and the Capuchin, these are the result of the life of St. Francis and the effort to organize that kind of life into an order. It became a very powerful order. The Dominicans were founded by Peter Dominic, hence the name. He was a Spaniard. He was a contemporary of Francis. Now, keep in mind that Spain was the most Catholic country at this time, in the late Middle Ages. In Spain and southern France, there was a great popular movement away from the Roman Catholic Church because it was so wealthy and so corrupt. We talked about the Renaissance popes, how immoral they were. And so there was, there was not a move away from Roman theology. There was a move away from the Roman system, the papal system, as it was carried out. And the leaders of the church were trying to find a way to stem this tide of apostasy. And it's sort of a Reformation movement at the start, at its beginning. Not full Reformation. And so, they were advised by Dominic, who was a very godly Catholic, Spanish Catholic, that it was not pomp and grandeur that would win back the masses, but preaching, austerity, apostolic humility, and genuine sanctity. Win back the masses who are apostatizing, leaving the Roman Church, saying that we're not going to, that the Pope's religion is, or the Pope has corrupted religion. Not going to do it by more of the same. What we're going to have to do is go back into the very simple kind of Christ-like life. Humility, sanctity, austerity, And so he founded an order of preaching monks, a Mendicant order. You understand what Mendicant means now, don't you? That is, they didn't stay in a monastery. They traveled around and lived off the people, off the land. Whereas Francis was afraid of books. He was not for learning. Dominic emphasized education as a preparation for the preacher. He required 4 years of general training at Central Florida Bible College and 2 years of theological training. And it's just like today, doesn't it? A B.A. and an M.D. You can call him that, but that's what he required. And the greatest theologians, as you might guess, of the age came from the Dominicans, and one of them was Thomas Aquinas. So we're dealing with this topically, so we can't, we don't all see all these factors considered. Thomas Aquinas, the great schoolman, the greatest of the scholastic men, scholastic scholars, writers, theologians, was a Dominican. Well, when the church decided on torture and force, the Inquisition That is, the Inquisition must augment preaching in the process of saving the Christian heretics. It was the Dominicans who were put in charge of the torture. There's something of a militia. There's a strong preaching order. But when the church decided that it wasn't doing enough and needed to really purify the church of the heretics and establish the Inquisition, which we're going to talk about before the end of this quarter, it was the Dominicans who were called upon to carry it out.
No.
The idea in that day that you oppose the violence, but not in regard to a heretic. See, Aquinas expelled it out. That if you destroy the sanctity of you destroy the idea of that salvation is only in connection with the Bishop of Rome. Anybody who threatens that threatens people's eternal salvation. They're worse than a murderer because they're killing more than the body, killing the soul. Therefore, anything goes because it's such a serious issue. There's a sort of a twisted logic in that, isn't it? Kind of convoluted logic. I list here that other Dominican orders, that although these did come to use monasteries that were started as Dominican orders, the Carmelites and the Augustinians, I simply refer you to Laterets, because I'm not going to take time to discuss these. These are less important at this period. Now, they become more important later on. By the way, we're going to see that just as Thomas Aquinas was a Dominican, Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. So we can see at the theological force, the importance of these orders, mainly because they emphasized learning and preaching in an age when preaching was dead, learning was almost dead. I summarize for us here the influence of the Dominican orders. First of all, initially they produced a genuine revival of religion, in Roman Catholic religion. Eventually, the orders were corrupted and fell from the high ideals of their founders. We talked about this cycle. So that's sort of the influence. Initially, produced revival. Eventually, they themselves were in need of revival, became corrupt, as they all did, one time or another. We come now to a very important consideration, and we must understand something of this if we're going to understand the Protestant Reformation, and that is the rise of what we call mysticism. Mysticism has always been an important factor in the history of the church. So that you'll know what I'm talking about, I define this. I define it thus. Mysticism is the direct intuition or experience of God, or that which claims to be. Now, I'll say this again, but you understand, this desire, you live in an age that was extremely ugly and corrupt, and where religion was little better than society. The only religion, the true religion, the Orthodox religion, the Catholic religion, the Holy Roman Apostolic Catholic Church, was just about as corrupt as those that the world was trying to win. Now, this creates a longing in the hearts of men. And mysticism is one of the things that happen whenever people feel like their religion is cold and dead and corrupt. What mysticism basically is a bypass, a heart bypass. As the heart bypasses, in some ways, the church, the organized religion, especially, in this case, the Roman Catholic Church was taught that the only way to God is through the channels of grace, that is, through sacraments, to seek a relationship with God that transcends or bypasses or sees through the sacrament. It's what's sometimes called a personal relationship with God, but in a mystic sense. And this parenthetical summary, this is very important, by the way, as it according to Roman Catholic tradition, as it was worked out in this age, as it's being taught in this age, and still taught today, in Roman Catholic theology, there are three paths to God. There is the lower road, which is minimum salvation through the sacrament. You spend a lot of time in purgatory. However, if you want to be a little bit better, do a little better job of it, there is the middle road, which is salvation with minimum purgatory through the sacrament, plus meritorious works and special devotion. That's the person who would do something special, become a priest, become a nun.
take a vow, do missionary work. In other words, to go beyond the simple sacraments, to be something special, to shorten your time in purgatory. They're in this, the high road of mysticism, a direct fellowship with God, which depends on neither sacraments or meritorious works, but rather on the experience of God. And the Roman Catholic Church has long recognized the mystics. It has never really been comfortable with them, but has never denied them. Many of the later Roman Catholic saints were mystics. You understand what mysticism is? The idea that your access to God is not by faith, not through the sacraments, it is immediate, direct, experiential, as opposed to being of faith. Now, I listed the basic kinds of mystics. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. There were the scholastic mystics. These were schoolmen and theologians, but also mystics. Bernardus Clairvaux was one of these. And you look at his hymns that he wrote, or is supposed to have written, you will see mysticism. Much said of this immediate contact with God. Now, there's some others here. Here was their problem, and they were analytical thinkers, being schoolmen of the scholastic bent. How can one be sure that he has really experienced God and not simply an emotional time of thinking about God? That was their problem. Still, sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Can you experience God? If so, how can you tell the difference between what you experience something? Is it God, or is it just an emotional experience of time of thinking about God? Their basic scheme of practical mysticism I list here had three basic elements: cogitation, which means thinking about God, studying about God. I'm sorry, cogitation was thinking about God academically, meditation, and then contemplation. These three working in concert produced sort of a working mysticism. The scholastic mystics. More important were the German mystics. Johann Eckert was a Dominican theologian. He believed that every man had in him a spark of the divine, which was the only true reality. Man's goal was to enter the conscious union with God. Sounds very pantheistic. By the way, many of these mystics did become heretics, did deny they became sort of dualists, extreme dualists, and denied the essentials of the faith. Johann Tauler, a group of men called the Friends of God from among the Catholic Church, devoted themselves to gathering and reading the writings of the mystics. And from this group, there emerged anonymously a very important book called German Theology, which is a handbook of German mysticism. It was a second kind of mysticism. It was one of the more influential books in the Middle Ages. It has come to be classified among the Christian classics. Luther said it was that the three greatest books in the world were the Bible, the writings of Augustine, and this book, anonymously published, German Theology, which is German mysticism. And I say that because this idea of mysticism, that you know God experientially, primarily, your primary knowledge of God is experiential knowledge of God, is very influential on Martin Luther, such that he listed this book as German mysticism as the three top books. Well, you can see the writings of Augustine. I've already established, have I not, that Lutheran theology is an attempt to bring the church back to Augustine, so we would expect that. And the Bible, Augustine, and German theology. We look at the Dutch mystics, very important, Dutch mystics. John Rijsbroek, he was the founder of a very important group called the Brethren of the Common Life in the lowlands, in the Netherlands, Holland. And by the way, that area was always much, and it's kind of like southern France. Later on, it was intellectually advanced beyond the rest of Europe. It was from Rotterdam that Erasmus came, the famous Erasmus that we're going to talk about next quarter, perhaps this quarter. But one of my favorite characters, Erasmus. Now, this was a semi-monastic group, sort of a something of a lay order, although it was not attached to any lay group, called the Brethren of the Common Life. which had tremendous and reviving influence on life in Europe. They worked principally in teaching and in schools. And you read the literature of this group, very devout, very godly. Keep in mind, this is among other things, an emotional reaction to a godless age. Another group of his followers organized a monastery at Windesheim, which later spawned a family of monasteries. Thomas A. Kempis, you must know who he is. You study him in Christian classics. Thomas A. Kempis was a product of this Windesheim Monastery, which was an outgrowth, which was a child of the Brethren of the Common Lodge. Do you see the connection here? Thomas A. Kempis spent 70 years at the convent of St. Agnes. He was in some way involved in the authorship of the work The Imitation of Christ, one of the great Christian classics. This book is the greatest of all Christian classics so far as its influence is concerned. You understand that? No book other than the Bible in the history of the church has had the influence. I'd say it's the best written or the most agreeable, but no book other than the Bible has had more influence or as much influence than this book, The Imitation of Christ, Thomas A. Kempis, who grew up, who was a part of the Brethren of the Common Life movement, who were Dutch mystics. And now, it's been read by more believers, I point out, than any other Christian book other than the Bible itself. In the late Middle Ages, it was read more than the Bible. And by the way, your education simply requires that you read Imitation of Christ. Not simply for academic purposes, but it is a great devotional book. We're going to get all the theology in it. It's mysticism. But the mystics, while I disagree with the basic epistemology of the mystics, in that I think that our basic relationship to God is one of faith, yet, so I disagree with the foundational theology of mysticism. You need to read the works of the mystics because they are great devotional aids, because they have great value insofar as they help us to think about our personal relationship with God, our personal piety, our personal devotion. Understand that? So, can you buy that? We seldom buy all the theology of books that we read. What I'm saying is The Imitation of Christ, while I do not recognize We do not recommend the fundamental theology of it. It is extremely valuable. As with Augustine's Confession, remember I've made the same comments about that. Yeah, you read The Imitation of Christ, you get many insights into your own life. Have you read it for Christian classes? Do you find it so? If you have to read it as an assignment, you tend to not like it. So I suggest you wait for a while, for a few years, till you get over your dislike for reading assignments, and pick it up and read it with your heart, as it were. You find many important insights into it. Well, there were the pantheistic mystics among the Dutch mystics. Lateret discusses these. I'm not going to get into that. Ancient Platonism and Gnosticism emerged in some of these mystics. In other words, we would recognize that many of these mystics became something very close to what the Christian Science cult is today. But they didn't all do that, yes. The popes were not the mystics. They didn't have to be. Everybody was involved in this. By the way, still today, you find one of the reasons, by the way, the theology of mysticism, that you know God primarily by an experience, secondarily by faith or the sacraments or whatever, this has always been recognized, or has since the Middle Ages, as the highest form of Catholicism. And I'll tell you why. You say, well, do they not deny sacramental religion? Well, I'll tell you why in just a minute when we summarize it. But if you trace this back, and I don't have time to do this, historically and theologically, the reason that the modern charismatic movement or neo-charismatic movement is a Roman Catholic movement today, it is dominated by the Roman Catholics, and both numerically and administratively. The reason that it has become that is because the only major religious group that had to change none of their doctrines whatever to accept charismatic theology was the Roman Catholic Church. Every other major group, you had people within the group that accepted neo-charismatic theology, they had to do so at the expense of their own traditional theology. Understand that they had to change their mind on a certain point to become a charismatic. The only group that didn't have to was the Roman Catholic Church, because neo-charismatic theology is medieval mysticism. You trace it back to its roots, understand what it is. It is medieval mysticism. It's the idea that the sacraments are okay, the church is okay, the faith is okay, but your primary relationship to God is mystical. Does it make sense to you? So this is why the Roman Catholics could accept this and change not a single doctrine. And interesting. And that's why, and some of their leaders of the old Pentecostal church didn't realize this. The old line Pentecostal man, and we'll deal with this in history of Protestantism later, but David Duplessis, who's a South African white man who came to America in the late 50s, he set it his goal to take this Pentecostal theology out of the Pentecostal church into the liberal churches, into the old mainline churches, and he did it. Lo and behold, he found that his greatest acceptance was among the Roman Catholics. Like they just took it on board like crazy. And as a matter of fact, he was a member of the Assembly of God Church, the Assembly of God preacher. He is again now. For many years he wasn't. The Assemblies of God kicked him out for a while because he was in effect in bed with the Roman Catholics. In fact, he made such statements as that papal infallibility was no problem to him. And he found himself openly, he found himself in a position where he could no longer take the traditional Protestant position that Roman Catholic theology was wrong. The reason he couldn't do that is the Holy Spirit was blessing Roman Catholics better than he was blessing anybody else. More of them were speaking in tongues than anybody else. See that? If you take the basic mystical approach that the experience is the standard, what was he to do? Who was he to say God was wrong? Obviously, he had been mistaken about the Roman Catholic Church. Well, he since come to his senses a little bit and backed off a little bit, and they let him back in the church. They restored his license to preach. Well, what I'm trying to point out is the reason this happened was all of a sudden he found himself, understand that? He didn't really intend to do that, but he found that the one group which really took this doctrine and ran with it was the Roman Catholic Church and the Episcopalian Church, which is Catholic in its theology. And if you add so it is primarily a Roman Catholic Episcopalian movement today. Do you know that, by the way? It certainly is. And this is the reason. That's just for future study and thinking. This is the reason why it is a movement that is dominated by Roman Catholicism, because, let me say it again, charismatic theology is medieval mysticism at its root and its heart. If you start with the idea that the personal experience with God is the standard, then such things as doctrine and sacraments and anything else are becoming consequential. That's why, by the way, Jim Baker can have the Roman Catholic priests on there and call them Father so-and-so and Brother so-and-so, recognizing there's no question of their salvation. You ever seen him on the PPL Club?
Yeah.
No question of their salvation, either, although they subscribe to every Roman Catholic doctrine. Why? Because they have had the same experience that he's had, and this is mysticism, that the canon, the rule, the standard is the experience. You all see that? It's so complicated. It's hard for us to buy, isn't it? But that's Yingy's shaking her head.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you in just a minute, okay? It is hard to believe. First of all, I summarize the character. Let me try to answer your question by going through with you this summary on the character of mysticism. First of all, it was a movement within the church, but apart from the church. Mystics were highly critical of sacramental theology. That is, just like we would be, right? The idea of indulgences and all that went with sacramental theology. But they never moved into heresy because they participated in the sacraments. They simply attached little importance to them. The Roman Catholic Church was always a little bit suspicious of mystics. They never could move them out. But you see, it's one thing. See, this is why Martin Luther got in trouble. He reduced the sacraments. He said five of those aren't even sacraments. There are only two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. Now, interestingly enough, a mystic would have less respect for, put less of his confidence in baptism and the Lord's Supper than Martin Luther would. And yet they were not heretics. Why? Because they participated in the sacrament. They simply took the approach that Erasmus took, and that is, that's okay. They don't really count. Erasmus was something that came out of this mysticism in a way. That is, don't worry about the sacraments. Physical things don't really count. Don't worry about it. If they're helpful, and it may be helpful, go ahead. Just realize that the sacraments are not the only channel of grace. And the Roman Catholic Church let them get away with this. There's not much to say about it because they did not deny the sacraments. In other words, they just didn't take them seriously. And you see that distinction? They simply attached little importance to them. They practiced them fully. Therefore, they were not heretics. Because they emphasized the inner life, they were not interested in doctrinal reform. One of the reasons that the mysticism, although it contributed to the Protestant Reformation, did not begin the Protestant Reformation, is that the Protestant Reformation we're going to see was a doctrinal reform, and mysticism is never really concerned about doctrine. Can you see that? You ever hear it? You ever hear the neo-charismatic leaders? You ever hear Jim Baker and Pat Robertson say, or Oral Roberts? Did you ever hear him say, listen, I don't want to talk about doctrine. Let's just talk about Christ and our relationship with him. You ever hear that kind of language? You hear it all the time. See, to a mystic, doctrine is inconsequential. They didn't care that much. The importance was this pious life, the inner life, the devotional life, the meditational life. Now, let's hear, is that making sense to you all? Hard for us to think about that, but that's the way it was, the way it is, too. That is always a character of mysticism. By the way, this is why, because of the overwhelming tide of subjectivism which has come into evangelical and fundamentalist theology, that is why the word doctrine today has become a bad word. Oh, he preaches doctrine. I don't want to hear all that doctrine. And you won't preach very long before somebody will lay that one on you. I don't want to hear about doctrine. I just want to hear about Christ. As if you could separate the two. Common ideas found in mysticism. Not all mystics. These were just sort of common ideas. God cannot be known by reason or by simply reading the Bible. He must be known by experience. You move from faith to experience. Secondly, a man must first withdraw and meet God before he is ready to go forth and serve man and God in the world. And we would say there's an element of truth in that, would we not? And, by the way, even the first one, we would say there's a little bit of truth in that. We would go as far as saying that intellectual knowledge of the Bible is not enough. We must have a personal prayer life. We must have a personal relationship with God, but still one of faith, but a warm personal faith. Third, if a man will get himself ready, God will pour himself into his soul. Mystics commonly held and do hold the idea that a really godly man is, in some sense, a little bit of God walking around. You often hear it today in the name of the Holy Spirit, the idea that the Holy Spirit sort of becomes incarnate in our spirit. And that's mysticism. Doctrinal thought among the mystics led in a general led in general away from the basic doctrines of God, man, and salvation as found in the Bible. They led them away. That mysticism did not lead men closer to the Bible. Mysticism, mystics embraced Mary as quickly as Christ. Do not misunderstand mysticism. Mysticism did not give these people a biblical direction or emphasis. Some did, some didn't. But there's nothing about mysticism that did that. Now, are you confused about what mysticism is? It's a you're going to deal with it all your life. You got to recognize this. Mysticism is a very attractive kind of ego-centered approach to God. There is, keep in mind, there is much the mystics have to teach us. Mysticism has many good things about it. And it did have, and it produced, it contributed to the Reformation. It was not the beginning of the Reformation. It could not be, because it led away from doctrine, whereas the Reformation was a doctrinal reform. In fact, in some cases, we're going to look at Martin Luther, the Lutheran Reformation, and say it went too far the other way. It's the eternal struggle between orthodoxy and orthopraxis, right believing versus right living. And mysticism is the extreme which says, if you know God, nothing else is required, nothing else is important, therefore they did not attack the sacramental system, did not attack Mariolatry, anything that would help. Extremely subjective. So you understand that? So it embraced the traditional doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church, embraced Mary, as I said, just as quick as it embraced Christ. It was not a biblical, it was a pious revival, a revival of personal devotion. It was not a revival of biblical thought. Mysticism is not biblical at its root. Mysticism denies the essential fact that God is always God and that we are not God and that our relationship to God, therefore, is always by faith, not by experience. As I've said a number of times before, the word experience isn't even in the Bible. Common Greek word for experience is not even in the Scriptures, in the New Testament. You know that? It's not even there. However, can you see this pendulum effect? From an ecclesiastical system that is extremely worldly, wealthy, corrupt, dishonest. Remember all those ways they would use to raise money? If people see through that, oh yes. And so here, and it was monolithic, it was the only way to heaven. So men who simply could not swallow that would go the other direction and say, okay, this is okay, we won't fight this, but We will know God not through the sacraments, not through the priest, not through the bishop. We will know God because we will meditate and contemplate and think and pray until we meet Him personally. Experiential, we experience God. You understand that? That's mysticism. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why so many of the mystics got into, you see, listen to me, many of the mystics got into heresy. You see, just if you have this experience with God, that's your basis of your knowledge. Listen to me. This is why many mystics were just as quick to embrace Mary as Christ, as I've said. But to many of these mystics, whether or not Jesus was the Son of God became inconsequential. By the way, let me say one more thing. You see, mysticism can reach over and embrace unbelievers in traditional doctrine. Because of the nature of it. This is why a great number of those, especially in the Episcopalian Church, who have always been apart from the earliest days of the modern neo-charismatic mysticism, are the existentialists. Existentialists, those who have only an existential kind of faith, and you know what that is. They entered this mysticism because, you see, a good mystic does not even have to believe that the Bible is the Word of God. Yes, and that's why you have hundreds of people who speak in tongues who would not take a stand on the deity of Christ and do not believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. By the way, and I said this before, you want to read one of the clearest expressions of theological existentialism, a presentation of that theology, it's in John Sherrill's book, They Speak With Other Tongues. The theology of that book is pure existentialism. And that's the book, by the way, that got Pat Boone into the tongues movement. And it's been very, it was the most influential book in the 60s in getting people into the tongue-speaking movement. It's an you understand that? So just like you had mystics back in this period who would end up being heretics that would deny this, not all of them. See? Even that doctrine became unessential. Whether or not Jesus was God. So today, mysticism has embraced theological existentialism for the very same reason.